Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 99-year-old Frank Costa of Las Vegas. Yes, I did say 99. He's originally from Geneva, New York, in the beautiful Finger Lakes region in the center of the state. I want to thank Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for letting me know about Frank, one of three brothers who all served our country during World War II. Frank was in the Pacific with the Wildcats of the 81st Infantry Division. He took part in the invasion and capture of Angar Island in the Palaus in September of 1944, moving on from there to relieve the 1st Marine Division on Peleliu. There was mop-up duty on the island of Leyte in the Philippines before training for the planned invasion of Japan, and eventually occupation duty right after the Japanese surrender. But those tense, dangerous weeks on Angar, was that the most intense action you ever experienced?
They all seemed the same to me. You're on the ground, you're going ahead, and you're going to see how far you get without getting hit, I guess.
And when you said initially with this tank, you're handling ammunition, what does that mean? You're grabbing it and handing it to someone else to load it?
When ammunition comes, there's so many powder bags.
Right.
They'll say for three, four, how many powder bags? Knock, say it says three. So you put three powder bags and break the other, throw the other one away. Then that shell is only going to go so far.
Mm-hmm.
If you want four, then you put four, and then it'll go that much further. Then we lost our tank in the second or third day. We're going through Buddy Gulch. As we were around the corner, cut in the canyon, in the mountain, as we took the corner, the Japanese had set up the gun in the far end. They caught our tank right in the turret, which disabled our turret. You couldn't turn it, and brought up on edge, disabled our tank. We were stuck there.
Where were you when the tank was hit?
I was outside. Uh-huh. Lucky. Nobody got killed, but Horace Buck got a shell through his leg. The two drivers got hit in the back of the head. When a shell went in, hit the back side of the inside the tank, and the shrapnel hit the back of their neck.
So if you had been in the tank for that, you probably would have got
dead.
Some. You'd have been dead.
Yeah, I've been dead because the shell hit where I was loading the gun.
And how recently had you transitioned from that job?
I was gone maybe 5 minutes.
You'd been in the tank 5 minutes before?
Yeah.
Why did you go outside?
Yeah, I really don't remember. All I remember, they opened the turret and says, do this. And I went out to do it, and next thing I know, clang.
So 5 minutes. If you hadn't left that tank, if you'd been still in there 5 minutes later.
Again, I'd have been gone.
But so then you see this. Your buddies are all hurt. Your tank is disabled. You can't move. So what'd you guys do?
We stayed there protecting what we could. Then the General Sherman tank come up from, I think it was the Marine Corps. I'm not sure. Bill Riley from my hometown was on that tank. He hollered, get that thing out of the way. And they put the chain and dragged our tank out. Then I found out Bill was on that tank.
What a small world.
Small world.
You're about as far from Geneva, New York as you can be.
That was it, and he moved on, and I moved on.
Were you scared?
Was I scared? I'd be lying if I said no. I was, as they would put S's. Yes, I was scared.
How did you keep going? How did you deal with that? I mean, you've just described.
Your buddies really will keep you going.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You got together with this, Paul, do you hear that? Yeah, I heard that. Okay, I'll watch the side, you watch that side. I mean, you were close, you were depending on each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, scared is not the word for it. It's just beat. I don't know how to describe it. But if I was to stand up on a thing, I'd be so shaking. Whatever was with me, I'd be shaking with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were all scared.
And how did you process losing guys around you, seeing guys killed right next to you?
I don't know how to explain that one. You just wish them luck when they went by you. That's about all of it. The ones that went down, there's nothing much you could do with them. I don't want to talk about that.
I guess the question that comes to mind in light of that is, did you ever feel like maybe I'm next?
Yes, more than once.
Think about your family back home?
I think you're thinking everything back east.
Did you ever get any mail from them while you were over there?
Mail every day. Every day they delivered mail, I got mail.
From Mom?
Mom. My sister wrote every single day.
Wow.
And Lena wrote every day.
Well, we didn't cover that. So Lena It's your wife of 69 years. You just lost her a couple years ago. So you guys knew each other before you went overseas.
I met her at the first dance in Marysville. I was at the barracks. I was up on the second floor writing a home letter to my mother. And the girls from the city came in on dance night. It was on a Wednesday night. Lena walked in the door, and I'm at the far end of that dance hall. And I spotted her. Closed the letter. I said, Mom, somebody just walked in. I want to meet. Talk to you later.
You wrote that in the letter?
Mm-hmm. And I closed the letter. I walked down the side of the balcony, got down the stairway. The girls went up the stairway that way to the room to take the coats off. Then they would come down the stairs, and the guys on this side came down the stairs, and they met in the bottom. That was a dance partner. I go down, and I 22. And I count 22 of mine. You can go, wait a minute, this way, that way. I got 22, and they're going down. Got as far as 8. She's 8th, and I'm 8. Just then a bunch of non-coms come in. They take the next 10 or 12 girls.
Oh.
I couldn't find her. Lena being short, 4'11", they took her, and she disappeared. She's here, and the crowd's up here.
You can't find her because she's too little, sure.
So I'm looking around, and finding Leo Kaufman. Little Jewish friend of mine from Connecticut. And Leo Kaufman come up to me and said, Frank, I met somebody I knew you'd like to meet. Leo, I'm not looking for her. I got somebody I want to meet and I can't find her. He said, oh, there she is sitting over at that table over there. I look, that's the girl I'm looking for. That's how I met her. He introduced me to her and I asked her for the dance. She had the dance. All her dances were taken.
Mm-hmm.
So when the tag dance came along, I tagged. I know sooner tag somebody tagged me back. So I went over to Leo. I says, "Get the gang and keep the guys off of me. I want to dance with her." So he got 4 or 5 of the fellas and they danced around her, and I got dancing. That's how I got to meet her.
That was quite an effort.
It was an effort. I asked her last name. She wouldn't give me her last name, and she says it starts with a Z. I said, just a minute, I'll be right back. So I went around the corner to the telephone booth. Looked in the telephone, there was only 4 Z's. So I got one with John and one with Gaetano. So I went back, your name, it starts with a Z, it would be Zanoni, would it? How did you find that out? I said, little birdie told me. I said, did your father Gaetano or John? And she said, you know more than I thought you did. She said, Gaetano's my dad. So then I said, okay, I got a couple of dances, and I asked if I could have a date coming up. I had to go to Grass Valley. No bus, no train, no nothing going to Grass Valley, 30 miles away.
Uh-huh. Hitchhiked it?
I had to hitchhike it.
Just to get a date.
And then at midnight, curfew.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh is right. I didn't know anything about it. So when I was at the USO there, Mrs. Morton says, where are you going to stay tonight? I said, I don't know. I'm going to have to get a place. She says, stay at my place tonight. And Spaghetti, a kid from Massachusetts, and I got to stay at her place. And the next morning, trying to get a bus out, nothing out. You had to get on the corner. But people were nice. We got to ride right away. So that's how I got to meet Lena.
What was it about her that made her so desirable to you that you had to pursue her to that extent?
Well, I don't know. Just looked, and that's the woman I want.
But then you had to leave. Did you have an idea before you left that this might be the one you're going to marry someday?
I was pretty sure, but I didn't tell her that. I didn't want to get married before I left, and I didn't want to be engaged before I left. I said, if anything happened, I don't want her to have me hanging over her.
Uh-huh.
So my mother caught on right away.
Well, you had written in the letter.
I said, somebody walked in, but when I said, I'm going to California, she knew right away.
Oh, after the war. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so when you go overseas, she was writing you nonstop.
Yeah. I wrote every single day.
You guys still have any of those letters?
Got a box there.
How about that? When you're overseas, the guy next to you has just been killed. You've almost been killed. You finally have a chance to rest, and you open up a letter from that girl back home. What did that mean to you?
That builds you right up. I meant everything. I got something to go home to. She kept me alive, I guess. I have Beauchel, couldn't read or write. Saw me with a pile of letters. He says, I wish I could get a letter from home. I said, why don't you write her a letter? He said, I can't write. I said, you can't write? No, he was from Oklahoma or Alabama or someplace. So I said, I'll write you a letter. So I put in care of the post office. Please read this for him. I put right on the letter. About a week later, Beauchamp comes back to me with a letter mailed to him. He brings it to me to read to him.
Uh-huh.
And the postmistress thought it was a good gesture for me to take my time to write to somebody that couldn't read or write.
And wow.
So I wrote three or four letters for Beauchamp. When he got out of the service, I understand my captain sent him to school, made him go to school, took care of him.
Wow.
I don't think he got a member of my company left. You know, I think they're all gone.
Mm.
We used to have reunions.
Uh-huh.
I missed every one of them. Something always came up. Then in the last meeting, Jim Snyder passed away, and his wife wrote and says, I don't think we have any more. Jim is gone. And I think, Frank, you're about the only one from the canning company left. So I don't know. I don't have any high school classmates. I don't have any army classmates. My job, all the salesmen are gone, all died.
Well, just wait till you're 103.
I won't have anybody left.
You told me about Beauchamp, and I'm sure that touches a lot of people to hear that seemingly little thing that you were able to do for him that meant so much. What else can you tell me about the guys that you served with and what you guys did for each other over there?
You were always doing something for each other. If you didn't feel good, I'd take over your job for you. We wouldn't send you to that sick bay. We wanted you with us. It was just one happy group. We worked with each other. We looked out for each other. And they're all gone. Hmm.
As far as the time you spent in the Pacific, you started Angar. You moved through this Palau chain. Peleliu was one of the major battles. There are a lot of smaller ones. You end up in the Philippines later on at Leyte. Throughout all that time, what was the most difficult thing for you to deal with?
I guess losing a buddy. Too much is coming back. I had to quit.
Sure. You know, I'm sure you can look back on a lot of moments where it could have been you, and those are individually for you, but there are some big picture things that happened too that maybe were the difference between you living or dying. You guys originally were scheduled to take part in the invasion of Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
What happened?
That's when we broke out with dysentery. Somebody didn't wash out the dishes and left the soapy.
Uh-huh.
And just broke out of the whole ship. So they brought us to the Philippines and in 98 took our place on Iwo Jima.
So you guys were actually on the ship headed to Iwo Jima.
We were in the Amber's heading that way.
So everybody got sick?
The captain and I are the only ones who weren't sick.
What was your secret to not getting sick?
I don't know. I guess I didn't eat what they ate. My captain said to me, you're coming with me, Frank. We're going off shore. All the guys were sent ashore, and the Navy guys who weren't sick were cleaning off the deck.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you're not staying here and cleaning them up. You're going with me.
But that outbreak of dysentery, as miserable as it was for those affected, probably
saved a lot of lives.
Maybe yours, too.
Yes. I often wondered about that.
And then another twist that I guess you might look at and say, hey, maybe that saved my life, would be Truman's decision to drop those bombs?
I'm sure it is.
Because you guys were training to invade Japan, right?
Yeah. We were supposed to have Iwo Jima and be stand-in for Japan, but we never made it. So after he dropped the bomb, we were the first troops to land in Japan.
Where'd you come ashore?
Aomori.
What'd you see?
When we got there, it was about 30 degrees below zero. I didn't have any heavy coat on. I just had a regular... I was picked out of the hills to be the forward OP. And when I got there, I had nothing. Company A captain says, where's your jacket, soldier? They picked me out of the mountains and put me in the ship. So he got a blanket for me, so I wore a blanket instead of a jacket. We walked into town. We walked on each side of the street, 50 feet apart. Be here, alternate.
Uh-huh.
And as we walked down the street, nobody was on the street but the police. And when we come up to them, they put their hands behind their back. While they're back to us, they were ashamed.
Mm.
And we walked through downtown. We marched it to the airport, and then we had to sleep on the ground because the barracks were all full of lice and hay. And we slept on the ground in the runway.
Out in the open when it's that cold. I guess upstate New York has nothing on that, huh?
No, it didn't.
How long were you there in Japan?
I got there in November, and we left there in February.
During that time, did you have much interaction with Japanese people?
Yeah, they turned out to be pretty nice. I was kind of leery at first, and then I got a TDY, sent on temporary duty. So they sent me to Tokyo. So they sent me there for a three-day weekend. And that's when I got to talk to a lot of the Japanese people. And they weren't too bad to talk to. And they were ashamed of what they've done.
How about just as far as witnessing the destruction, the way some of these places were decimated? Did that make an impression on you?
In the part of Japan where I was, there was no destruction at all. But where the bomb was dropped was just 100 miles, I'd say, from where we were.
Gotcha. I was referring to Tokyo, where the firebombing, from what I've seen and read and heard, was so widespread, the destruction was just overwhelming. Time for another break, but we're going to hear what Frank experienced on his honor flight to Washington, D.C., including a moment that wasn't planned, but added even more emotion to his wreath-laying at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And remember when Frank was describing that scene in Angar's Bloody Gulch when his tank was hit and it was blocking the other tanks from getting through? If you go to hometownheroesradio.com and pull up that War Department film recorded on Angar in 1944, you're going to see a very similar scenario. And whether it's Frank's tank or not, you'll see exactly what he was talking about and what he was dealing with. And maybe you'll imagine what in the world you would have done if you were in that situation. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.